It has touched every one of us, sparked wars and corporate collapse, and it comes in nearly infinite forms. Cheating. When I say economic cheating, what do you say?
Well, that's a difficult one.
Think of Wall Street.
Stocks.
Ponzi scheme.
Investment bankers.
Insider trading.
Hi, I'm Lisa Desjardins, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of February 6th, 2015. Cheaters, of course, come in all shapes and sizes, and while some are out to make a quick buck at someone else's expense, the issue is not as obvious as you may think. Not all cheating is bad, and sometimes we are the ones cheating ourselves. This is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Lizzie is away this week working on an exciting project with our partners at the BBC. She'll be back in the big chair soon, I promise. In the meantime, this week, we are talking about cheating. When you think about it, deception is a huge part of the economy. I don't just mean insider trading or insurance fraud, but every day. Marking up prices ahead of a sale, padding the resume, hiding a big purchase from your spouse. We want to hear about how you've financially cheated or been cheated on. Talk to us by visiting marketplaceweekend.org and clicking on Go. You can also visit us on Marketplace's Facebook page or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We will start big for this cheating show with a story of what happens when you cheat on a massive scale. You may not know the name Aaron Beam, but you might know the company he founded, Health South, the largest owner of rehab hospitals in the United States. In the 90s, Beam began what would become one of the biggest accounting scandals in recent history.
My story started at HealthSouth, which was a publicly held New York Stock Exchange company. I was the founder of that company and was the CFO for 13 years. And the good news is it was a huge success financially. Our stock traded very high. And unfortunately, I did become involved in a corporate fraud of, as the term goes, cooking the books. When you're a public company, there's tremendous pressure to meet Wall Street expectations. You're really measured by, does the stock go up? It's a little bit like being a football coach. If you win football games, you're a hero. If you lose, not so much. So the pressures to meet Wall Street expectations are tremendous. You have to report earnings four times a year, and every quarter they like to see it go up, be better than the previous quarter. You sort of learn to lie. You become evasive. When the analysts and stockholders talk to you, of course, they're prying for information about how the company is doing. And you learn very quickly that you have to be very guarded in what you say. So when somebody suspects that the company is having a problem in some area, you do what is commonly called, you put lipstick on the pig. We were missing our numbers. We were not doing as well as we told Wall Street we would do. And out of fear of disappointing Wall Street, out of fear of losing my wealth, because my wealth was tied to the stock, I had a lot of the stock, out of not wanting to disappoint other people, employees. We had 60,000 employees who enjoyed seeing the stock go up and it made them proud that they were an employee of the company. You start cheating because you want to please these people. You want to deliver good numbers to Wall Street. Sometimes the public just thinks you do it because you're dishonest and you just want to, in essence, steal from the company and put money in your pocket. But I think in my case, that was pretty far down the list of why I did what I did. I participated in the fraud for about 1 year, and then I left the company because I really found that I couldn't live with myself. But 6 years after I left the company, the fraud broke. One of the employees at the company called the FBI and said, look, we've been doing this. And once it hit the news and everything, I came forward and turned myself in. What happened next was I was interviewed by the FBI and the SEC. Of course, they want to know who else was involved. And I was very honest with them. I didn't try to protect anybody or hide anything. I just tried to answer as truthfully as I could. I did not have to go to trial. I pled guilty. So it was just a matter of me waiting to be sentenced. Now, the CEO of the company did not confess that he had been involved. He said he knew nothing about it, and that he was taken to trial, and I was a witness in his trial. He was found not guilty and never went to prison. I got 3 months in federal prison, which is, I'm very fortunate that I got only 3 months. This was maybe one of the 10 largest corporate frauds in the history of the United States, and I got only 3 months, and I'm very thankful that it turned out that way. People talk about life-changing events, and I was kind of on top of the world. I was a wealthy man, but I disgraced myself. I embarrassed my family. I went to prison. I had to pay fines and restitution that took away all of my wealth. And particularly while I was in prison, I began thinking about, why did I do what I did? Why did I do it? And for the past 5 years, I've been speaking about why people commit these kinds of frauds and what you can do to be an ethically strong person. What is my life like now? You know, I really, really am a different person. I really try to conduct myself in a very ethical way. Money is not as important to me as it was. In fact, it's kind of down on my list. Right now, I'm 71 years old. My health is real important. My marriage survived. I've been married 44 years, and that's very important to me. Truly, I think I'm happier and more focused and have a better handle on life now than when I was running in the fast lane, literally making millions of dollars every year.
Aaron Beam is the former CFO of HealthSouth. He is the author of Ethics Playbook. And in case you're wondering, he tells us he now lives modestly and drives a Toyota Corolla. Now, a quiz. A one-question cheating quiz. You are thirsty. You have no money. You've got nothing to drink. You open your office fridge, and under that magical light, you find 6 cans of Coke and 6 $1 bills. There's no one watching. Do you take anything? A man named Dan Ariely can probably tell you exactly what you do. Ariely is a professor at Duke University. He studies cheating behavior, and he's run dozens of experiments. I started by asking him a basic question. Why do we cheat?
There's lots of motivations to cheat. For example, caring about other people, white lies, doing something that is good. I've been talking to lots of big cheaters, and everybody I've talked to started for very non-selfish reasons. The company was not doing so well. They had this accounting thing. People were taking tremendously personal risks to help a company, right? Eventually, those people went to jail themselves, but they started by wanting to help the company. So our motivations are often social and not individual.
Can you talk about how we rationalize cheating in the economy?
Rationalization is one of the best things that we do as people. Like, we're unbelievably good at this. And there are many ways to rationalize. So, for example, one of the ways to rationalize is that we're doing something for somebody else. Another rationalization is not seeing who is suffering. And that's incredibly common in the financial market. So, you know, what we see is when people come and they steal money from us, they steal much less than if they steal it by stealing first tokens, something that doesn't look like money, that then becomes money.
Right. The farther away you are from directly taking money, the more you think it's okay. I know you had a great experiment where you put like 6 Cokes in a fridge in college and all $6, and the college students all stole the Coke, but they didn't take the money. And so there's something that you're getting at there where we rationalize taking goods that we feel we need versus taking money that seems like it's directly coming from someone. So I want to bring this all back around to the economy. We're at a time when we are more than an arm's distance from the products that we buy. We buy things online through computers. We don't see anyone who makes them. We don't even see the people who ship them. We're paying for things with credit cards that are just numbers. It's not dollars in our hands anymore. Does this mean that we may have more incentive to deceive because the internet is a little bit more arm's length, at least in that one part of our economy?
So I think the answer is absolutely yes. The way things are going right now, we have a much easier time being dishonest and rationalizing. Think about all the people who download illegal content online, right? Those same people would never go to a coffee shop and have coffee and escape without paying, even if nobody could catch them. We do need to think about how we're going to fight it. What kind of system do we want to create so that our human nature that is common to all of us would not let us go down this path? Because if we go down this path, it's just not good for anybody. We have to understand that trust is a common good. If everybody trusts everybody else, life is good. The moment we stop trusting each other, the fabric of society really deteriorates, and we're all going to pay that price for a very long time.
There's something I can't quite get my head around, but I want to ask you, what would our economy, what would our world look like without any cheating?
So first of all, when we think about the world without cheating, let's think about our personal lives. And ask yourself, you know, would you like to live with somebody who always told you the brutal truth? Right? Think about things like your breath is smelling, you have green things between your teeth. There's lots of stuff that we just don't want to know. The reality is that it's not clear that we want a perfect, honest world. It's also clear that we don't want a perfect, dishonest world. And the real question is, how do we balance it? And how do we balance it differently in the social realm and in the business realm? And I think the other element to figure out is that it's really about biased incentives. We need to understand that conflicts of interest are incredibly damaging for society.
Dan Ariely, the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics and an honest man in a very tricky world. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
There are cheaters in every type of business, but what about the business of cheating? I'm logging on to a fake account that we set up on AshleyMadison.com, a website that connects people who want to have affairs. Now, I have a bias. I think cheating in a relationship is wrong. But this is about dissecting a business with 30 million users. The website itself is pretty polished with purple and gray tones. We chose the very unhither username Doing Research 2015. And even so, that instantly brought heaps of responses from men. We had a lot of questions for Noel Biederman. He's the founder and CEO of Avid Life Media, which owns Ashley Madison. I started by asking him to explain the business of cheating.
The perfect affair is usually meeting someone and not being discovered by your significant other. If you do it in the workplace, if you do it on a singles dating service that's not designed for that purpose, your chances of success are much, much lower. And so I thought I could reinvent the wheel in that regard and create a dedicated marketplace around the unfaithfulness.
This is, of course, 2015. It's not 1950. But you know, to some people, that's still very shocking. And we looked around your website, of course, but I noticed in your FAQs, you have a question, does Ashley Madison encourage infidelity? And the answer on your website is no. I'm going to read from that. It says, Ashley Madison does not encourage anyone to stray. If you're having difficulty with your relationship, you should seek counseling. Then it adds, however, if you feel that you'll seek a person other than your partner, we believe our site is the best place to start. Is that a little bit like saying, we don't encourage you to smoke, but if you're going to smoke, try our brand?
You know, I don't think you can encourage infidelity. What I mean by that is, you know, you have listeners listening in shows. I could beg and plead with them, or I could sit down and talk to you one-to-one and say, please use my service. If you're content in your relationship, I have zero chance of success. So in a 30-second TV commercial, do you think I can convince people to have affairs? Something as significant as being unfaithful in your partner cannot be done through persuasion. It tends to happen because you've spent a decade together. There's now a massive void in your relationship. Whatever those motivations are, they come from within the relationship. They don't come from an external source, like a marketing campaign by Ashley Masson. And so what I've done is I've cannibalize an already existing behavior pattern. We all know that long before I created Ashley Masson, we were unfaithful as a species. What I have done is created a more perfect affair. I've assembled two like-minded people who are willing to engage in this. That's better off than one person who knows what they're getting into and one who doesn't. So no, I can't persuade anyone to have an affair, nor do I need to be honest with you, because whether you believe it's 3% of the population in any given year or 30% of the population, it's a large enough population to fuel what's now a $1 billion economy on the Ashley Masson platform.
I've seen data saying maybe 20 to 40% of heterosexual marriages someone cheats, but you're right, it's not clear. One thing, though, you talk about sort of your business model. You established this business model, but now you have a lot more competition, including Tinder, which is free. And a lot of people might think, you know, I can cheat on my spouse for free. How do you keep your site profitable? How do you compete with these other very easy ways to cheat for free?
Truthfully, when you're taking the level of risk you are when it comes to something like an affair, you're not going to pursue free. That isn't the motivating factor. The motivating factor is discreet, right? The motivating factor is undiscovered. And so I don't think Tinder is actually a competitor of ours. I think it's moved a lot closer to the more casual elements of online dating versus, say, where eHarmony started and where Ashley Masson kind of has been the darker side of dating, or so it's been described. I think Tinder is much closer to my neck of the woods than, say, some of these other services. But it's sure really is not a place where married people should go to. I'm not saying they don't, but it's not where they should gravitate if they want to have a perfect, discreet affair.
So in a way, you're saying you're in the risk management business.
We are. You know, when I look at the products we build, the features, I'll give you an example. You might have a Facebook profile. Your listeners might have a dating profile. If and when they're finished with that dating site and they say, okay, delete that account, what they do is take it out of circulation, right? But their historic participation in that service, the messages they sent, the photos they shared, they remain. They remain part of that history. Not so on Ashley Masson. If you are finished with having an affair and you want to pretend you were a ghost, like you never existed on that platform, I will do that for you. I will go back in time, recall every message you ever shared, every photo you ever sent, make it like you had never existed on this platform, impact another user's experience to the point where I will remove it from my own servers to so that I don't even have any trace of you being here. Only a service focused on something like discretion, because they know the level of affairdom, would engage in that kind of technology. But that's what we do.
And to point out, you do that for a cost. If someone wants to delete their profile, they have to pay a fee. So let's talk about how you make money off of this.
So the way we make money is we're a communication platform at the end of the day. People send email messages, so asynchronous communications. They chat real time. That could be in a fantasy date room or in a chat client. Or they can send virtual gifts, you know, a virtual rose, champagne bottle. So we make money through those communication platforms. And the way it works is a bit different than a dating service where you tend to subscribe for X number of months and pay a monthly fee. We don't do that. We charge per communication. And we do that for a number of reasons. You know, one positive one being that once you open a line of communication on Ashley Masson, it's free thereafter. There's no reason to move it to your personal email account or text that person. That's digital lipstick, right?
But you pay to open up that conversation. You pay when you're...
Correct.
If you're a man, you pay to start a conversation with someone.
What we originally did when we built Ashley Masson is that the initiator of the conversation is the person who will pay to initiate that conversation. We'll expend the 5 credits, let's say. But what we found was 99.8% of the time, men initiated the conversations. And so it made sense at some point in time to just message it differently, which is, why not just merchandise it more clearly? Women don't pay to use Ashley Masson. That is correct.
This goes to a lot of theories of marketing in general, how you market to men and women. It has sort of this interesting moral component, obviously. I'm also interested, from your viewpoint, how do you represent yourself to strangers when you meet someone new? What do you say that you do?
That might be one of the biggest challenges of being the founder of Ashley Madison. In all honesty, you know, I happen to live in a community where, for the most part, because of our business success and our acumen, I think, you know, at least to my face, I'm pretty lauded versus, you know, disliked. But the challenge is the unknown, not to my friends or my colleagues. But when I set foot into kind of a new realm, when someone invariably asks me what it is that I do for a living, I take pause because a number of different outcomes can happen. Someone could throw their drink in my face. You know, blame me for all that's wrong in their lives. The minimal opportunity I have to seize up the person beside me and figure out, you know, in the next 5 hours, this could be an uncomfortable journey or it could be a comfortable one. But I, for the most part, tell them the truth and see where it plays out.
I know that you've also launched other websites, and Ashley Madison by far is the most successful of your profile. And I can almost hear our listeners saying, why are you treating this as a legitimate business? This is something that is immoral. This is something that's a problem in society. What's your argument for saying, no, this is a legitimate business like any other? I know you, for example, have run into places where you can't advertise.
Well, you're correct. There's a lot of obstacles to our success, but that just says a lot about, I think, both our ability to operate a business, but more about the appetite for it, right? So businesses are created to fill demands as long as those are legal and can be put into place. We have come to understand that marriages break down, that infidelity is more a symptom and not the cause. And so in this backhand way, as a society, we have relaxed our morality around it. It might be one of the last bastions of immoral behavior. Monogamy is a long and held to notion, but really it came from an economic construct. It wasn't that there was some great social science behind, oh, hey, look, you know, couples in monogamous relationships do so much better. It was because at some point in time in our history, we started owning things and we wanted to pass those ownership stakes on to our progeny. And to do that, we need to have rules. We didn't have DNA testing 700 years ago. So we said, you should be faithful. Yes, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. I saw a market opportunity and I filled that. You know, what is Ashley Madison worth, generating the revenues we do? If it's anything under $1 billion, I would be in shock. But I also recognize, given the morality question of my business, I may never get a single investment dollar at that level. It just may never happen for me, but I'm okay with that. You know, it's ultimately going to be my legacy. And if someday an organization recognizes what it is that we have and handsomely rewards us for building it, that's tremendous. Otherwise, I'm happy to continue making the tens of millions of dollars that we do every single month.
Noel Biederman, founder, CEO of Ashley Madison, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
This pre-Valentine's week, we are talking about cheating in business, in our personal lives, our finances, and in tech. And on the internet, there is a lot of cheating going on. Some good, some bad. But one of the good cheaters is Parisa Tabriz. She is a hacker and security manager for Google. She joins me now to talk about hacking for good. Parisa, welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thanks for having me here.
All right. Let me just cut right to it. Your business card says your title is Security Princess. Do I have that right?
That is right. That's my official title at Google.
And awesome.
It's a self-appointed title.
You're basically in charge of the folks who are trying to test Google's limits, come up with ways to penetrate the security, right? And before someone else comes up with them.
Yep, exactly. The people that I manage, they come from a really wide variety of backgrounds, but some of them, you know, are skilled with finding security bugs and actually figuring out how to exploit them. And then with that knowledge, they figure out how to make our defenses better within Chrome.
How do you get the job of being a good guy hacker? I know some people say white hat hacker. How do you get this job? Because it strikes me that to be on the good team, at some point, Parisa, I'm guessing you were out there hacking, maybe not on a good team or in some middle team or some other team.
Were you going to say I was on the bad team?
You might possibly. I'm wondering, were you?
Yeah. So a lot of people talk about the white hat hackers, and this is where I think you have this notion of someone who's completely altruistic and, you know, they adhere to this strong code of ethics. And then at the other extreme, there's the black hat hacker. And this is where people are absolutely bad and malicious and only breaking into software for personal gain at the cost of others. And I think it's, you know, humans are more complex than this, and it goes for hackers too. And I think there's this spectrum between the two where people, they have their own set of ethics and their own motivations. For my part, I can say that I got interested in security in college, and I had a website and it got hacked and defaced by someone, you know, it had Viagra ads that had been like put on it. So I was interested in how this happened. And I got more interested in the weaknesses in software and what you could do that the original programmer didn't intend.
As we look at cheating this week, one theme woven around this show is the idea of how much money you make or how much money you lose from cheating. I'm curious, how much money do hackers make? How much money do good guy or white hat hackers make versus the bad guy or black hat hackers? How much money is out there?
So I have a limited insight. I know how much Google and other companies will pay for security engineers. And then also I just, you know, talk to people that work either in the public sector. So there's a lot of, you know, need for people familiar with security in our national security branches to kind of protect against cybersecurity threats. And then you can be a freelancer or an individual consultant. And it depends on what you're doing. So I think you can make a good living as a consultant that analyzes systems for a salary that's competitive to an engineer. Or if you're really skilled at finding bugs and can turn these software bugs into exploits, which you can almost think of as a weapon, that becomes a product that you can sell to a bunch of different people. And the usual avenues are you can sell it to a government, either foreign or domestic. You can sell it to some kind of criminal group, or you could sell it to some kind of third-party broker. And all of this is unregulated. So when it comes to talking about money, it's hard to give absolutes. But, you know, I've heard 5 to 6 figures for a very severe bug is not atypical. And it's not really surprising to me. One of the things that we do at Google is we also pay security researchers that let us know about bugs that they find, we pay them rewards. And this can be anywhere from a couple hundred dollars to tens of thousands of dollars. And Google does this, and it's good for us because it means that we find out about bugs and can make the software more secure. It's good for the researchers because they get some, you know, incentive to actually do this work. So it's kind of good all the way around. And that's, of course, the preferred way that I would hope people make money from this if they're not working at a company.
When you think about the salaries for your folks, are these people who just don't want to take that risk to become kind of the dark side hacker?
This is a stable job, but I think that also people's motivations do come into play. And, you know, just because you know how to do something doesn't mean that you, you know, are going to take advantage of that to harm other people. And all the people that I work with, you know, just because they know how to exploit software doesn't mean that they would want to. And they really do use that knowledge to make things that their friends and their family and that themselves can use to keep them safe while they enjoy the internet, which opens the doors to tons of possibilities, and they just want to make things that other people can use and stay safe.
So we're talking about cheating this week, and let me ask you, are hackers cheaters?
You know, all software or all software programs, they're written by humans or a number of humans. So they have sort of, you know, an idea of what the software should do and what the rules are, and then they need to translate that into code. And hackers, they don't so much think about what the humans, you know, intended. They look at the code and what's possible in the code. And, you know, in that sense, they're playing by those rules. And I think, you know, when you talk about what they're going to do with that afterwards, then it becomes an ethics thing. Like, are they going to use the flaw and tell the software vendor to fix it? Or are they going to use the flaw and try to profit off of someone? But, you know, I don't think it's that they're necessarily cheating. They're just not assuming too much about what the people who built it intended.
An honest answer that may make those of us who are not hackers a little nervous.
Well, so here's a non-software example. You know, if you watched TV in the late 80s, you probably saw MacGyver, right? He was this fictional secret agent.
Absolutely. Yes. He could do anything.
Yes. And, you know, was he cheating when he used a paperclip to escape from a burning building? I think of MacGyver as a hacker, and the people who make paperclips didn't necessarily intend for that to be used as a lockpick, but I think he was able to, you know, use it when it counted.
What's the future here? How quickly are hackers evolving? What is the direction, do you think, hacking's going to go in now?
If we think about hackers that are the people that just kind of tinker with software and find holes, you know, I think that's always been there, even before computers, and that will continue to be there. I think one of the things I've seen in the space where people are actually working as hackers and making a living off of this, it's become a lot more diverse in the past 10 years, where you can make money and a living off of this in a lot of different ways. And I think that will continue to evolve, you know, where there's probably a lot of different professions you can work on in this space. And it's going to be, you know, an increasingly important part of everyone's lives as we use technology more to get things done. And the more we depend on it, I think security is going to be a bigger part of that.
Farisa Tabriz, engineer and security princess for Google, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
As you heard, we asked Tabriz if hackers are cheaters. How about you? Take our short quiz about cheating at marketplaceweekend.org. Last week, we asked you to tell us your own stories about financial cheating, and our inbox at marketplaceweekend.org saw some great responses, including one from Jane Schumacher of Boulder, Colorado. She likes to hide bags of stuff that she's bought from Nordstrom in the trunk of her car, and then she sneaks them inside when her husband's not home. On social media, a doctor reached out to us. He asked that we not identify him by name. We did check his background. Let's just call him Dr. Joe. Joe told us that many of his colleagues regularly cheat the government. These doctors, he says, upcode their bills for Medicaid or Medicare. That means they charge for more elaborate procedures than they actually performed, sometimes making up procedures altogether. What's interesting is Dr. Joe said he would never do that. But he admits that he does upcode sometimes with Medicaid because he feels the pay rate they offer is so low he can't afford to take their clients otherwise. Finally, there's Chris Norden of Carlsbad, California. After reading a book by none other than Abby Hoffman in the late 60s, Norden says he felt big corporations were taking advantage of individuals. Since then, the retiree says he has tried to cheat corporations a few dollars here and there. Norden tells us he recently took a $100 gift card to test drive a Cadillac.
There was some kind of a deal site that I learned of it on. You sent in your name and your email address, and you kind of registered with them to test drive a Cadillac. And the deal was, if you did that, I guess Cadillac was feeling so well about this particular model that they figured if you test drove it, you'd fall in love with it, and they'd give you $100 just to make sure you test drove it. So I took them up on that and figured out a way to do it a couple of times instead of just once, and, you know, made a couple $100. I think I had another one 10, 15 years ago where they gave you $50 to drive a pickup truck or something like that. If I see something on the internet and it's a good deal, even if an email wasn't sent to me, if I learn of the deal, I might use a code that I learned of and get it by their computer system. I'm always looking for ways to get it over a little bit on the corporations. I don't have any moral compunctions about doing something like that. I would never think of stealing a nickel from an individual, but if it's a corporation, I just look at it. I look at it differently, and I just don't feel any moral responsibility towards getting any money out of them that I can. I would never hurt anybody any individual in the process. If somebody was going to lose their job because of something that I did, I certainly would not do it. But once again, I don't feel that if a corporation makes an offer such as that, and I take advantage of it, despite the fact that I'm not going to do what they hope that I will do, then that's just all part of the game. So I'm playing the game, and most of the time they are winning, but every once in a while I get a chance to win.
Next week, we are talking about mobility. In your economic life, in the world, do you feel like you are upwardly mobile? How is the American dream working out for you? To share your stories of mobility, go to marketplaceweekend.org and click on Go. You can also visit us on Marketplace's Facebook page or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Now that we've heard plenty of cheating stories, you may be wondering what to do if someone cheats you. Or what if you're the one with the financial secret? How do you come clean? Here to help us with this is Lauren Lyons-Cole, personal finance consultant and contributor to TheStreet.com. Lauren, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Lisa.
What do you see out there in terms of how are we financially cheating on people we love?
I think there's a lot of different ways that people financially cheat, and they're not all on purpose or intentionally cheating. I think sometimes we're just keeping secrets to protect the other person, or it could be that it didn't even occur to us to share with them. So the big thing with financial cheating is to increase communication between you and your partner. That's really what it comes down to.
Now, I am somewhat distantly connected to someone who I know has financially cheated on their spouse. They actually have a secret bank account that they were using. Now, again, this is someone kind of several layers distant from me, but I do wonder how often that kind of thing happens, how often we financially cheat with bank accounts and those sorts of things.
Well, you know, it's strange. When you partner up with someone, you go from this this perspective of having all the money. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's your money and then it becomes our money. And that is not always an easy thing. I mean, we think, okay, great, we just get shared bank accounts and life goes on. But really, there's a lot of choices that we make on a day-to-day basis when it comes to our money. And so we can really learn a lot about each other through talking about money. So if you can sit down with your significant other and express the things that are important to you, even if they feel silly, you know, if both people can approach that conversation with an open mind, you could probably do away with any financial cheating that's going on.
All right, let's talk about that specifically. This is great. This is where we roll up our sleeves and give people actual advice in their lives. One of our listeners wrote in and told us that she does, in fact, buy things at Nordstrom that she knows her partner doesn't want her buying, but she keeps it in her trunk until her husband is gone and then sneaks it into the house. How would someone in that situation recognize that perhaps there's a financial secret that they don't know about?
So this is the tricky part, because we are talking about two people. And if you're the person who's doing the financial cheating and you're aware of the fact that, you know, you're having to sneak in items because your partner wouldn't approve, it can be difficult to bring up the conversation. So I think this is where we have to remember that we've all been raised. We've got different money thoughts, money values. And so approaching the conversation slowly can help. Like, if you haven't even started talking about money yet with your partner, maybe don't start with the financial cheating. Start with something easier and say that you want to start sharing money goals together. You want to start talking about your budget together and establish a set time. I personally like Saturday mornings over brunch, maybe with mimosas, a time where it's not emotionally charged for you to sit down and to start talking about the money. And maybe you can work your way up to the financial cheating conversation.
You definitely have me with the mimosas. I'm in on it. I feel like I want to meet with you next week to discuss our finances.
Let's do it.
I want to look at this from the other way really quickly to kind of round this out. Say someone is a financial cheater. What mistakes might they make, or what ways might they get bit by their financial cheating? We all kind of want karma to work sometimes. Are there ways in which if someone is financially cheating on another person in their business and their lives that maybe they end up losing in the end? They're trying to get ahead, but maybe they lose.
From a personal finance perspective, I guess my response to that would be, if you are cheating on a spouse, there's probably a reason. There's probably a lack of education. There's probably something about money you don't understand, or some sort of emotional ties that you have to it. And so that, to a certain degree, is losing, just because you have to overcome those things in order to move forward with your own financial goals. So I think that's, you know, a big part of it. But also something to keep in mind whichever partner you are in that situation, if this becomes so stressful that it leads to a divorce, you're both going to be the losers. Because in a marriage, there's shared assets, but there's also shared debt. So if you get to a place where you're breaking down the marriage, both people, well, I guess the financial cheater will have benefited from the money they were spending, but it's going to not be a pretty sight. So not something to look forward to.
Say you are the person who has a financial secret from someone you love. How do you come out about that?
I really think in this situation, you might benefit from bringing in a neutral third party because it is such an emotionally charged thing and it's going to be difficult. And you might almost need someone there to push you along as you're telling, and also to help translate so that, you know, obviously the person's going to hear it and they might be defensive. So whether this could be a therapist, it could also be a financial advisor. So whoever you think is the right person, someone that you trust, not a family member and not a friend. It needs to be a neutral third party.
Lauren, I'm wondering, do people cheat on themselves financially? I know that's a little existential, but I am wondering how is it that people cheat on themselves and how should they avoid that?
Well, you're asking someone who would love to answer this question. The way that people cheat on themselves, if you're secretly spending money from a financial planner's perspective, that tells me that you are not saving for retirement. You are not saving to buy a house. You are not saving for your child's education. So anytime you're spending money, you're taking away from long-term savings priorities. And if you're doing it in a secret way, that makes me even more nervous. So it's definitely something that can negatively impact your own personal financial security. The way that I approach savings, I mean, it's just spending in the future. So if you can talk yourself into it from that perspective, I mean, getting in control of your finances may not be the most fun thing to do, but it's definitely the right thing to do. And, you know, maybe this is a good reminder or a call to action for people who are listening.
Lauren Lyons-Cole, certified financial planner and contributor to TheStreet.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
So far, we've been talking about cheating on purpose, but some cheating happens by accident, say when the rules have changed or people are confused. And the Grand Canyon of unintended mistakes are taxes. This year, paying Uncle Sam is significantly trickier than usual because now the new healthcare law hits your tax form. A very quick explainer. With some music, it's kind of a cheat to make it more lively. On tax forms now, everyone must tell the IRS whether they had health coverage last year. If not, it's a penalty. It's no problem if you got health care through your job, but it's not as simple for those who didn't. That's complication number one. Number two, millions of people who received government subsidies for health care may have received too much. They may have overestimated their need a year ago. So now all of those people are supposed to figure that out and send the extra money back to the IRS. And those are just the biggest of the potential snags. The situation is producing a tax season like no other for accountants.
The stress this tax season is double than what we have had in the past years because every single return we have to make sure we've covered everything for the Health Care Act. And make sure we don't file returns without it so that the clients get information letters from IRS.
Tax accountant Poonam Bansal, as you just heard, is pretty stressed about all this. We thought that made her the perfect person to interview.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Bansal owns a small firm called Accounting Solutions, and I found her in her office up a flight of stairs in a shopping plaza in Northern Virginia. It's the one just above the Mediterranean restaurant. She had a few papers on her desk, but it was remarkably neat, considering this is her busy season. The room is bright, and she's the kind of accountant who gives extra time to her clients and offers tea and coffee several times. We had met before on a different tax story, but she told me this year is extraordinary.
This is a very, very, very big change. We haven't had such a big change for years. And this practically affects every single return. And we as accountants are actually beginning to get into the mindset that we have to get this information from clients because clients know nothing about it. And we are gearing up, getting ready in our mindset. So every return we have to declare if they had health insurance coverage, where did they have it from? If it is from the workplace, it's easy. If not, then it gets very tricky.
So, you know, this week on our show, we're looking at cheating, and we wanted to look at this particular issue in the tax code right now in terms of, could people accidentally cheat?
Well, I wouldn't comment on cheating because I hope no taxpayer cheats. However, errors will be there. In our own office, we are being very meticulous, but I think still, either due to us not getting information or us not asking for the information, 1 in 100 return will probably have a question about the healthcare part because somebody will forget to tell us, oh, 1 month I was uninsured. And if you do your own taxes, this year particularly, I feel will be very, very tough. And, you know, if you can do it, wonderful. But again, if you were employed and your employer gave you insurance, that's the easiest part. You should be able to do your taxes very easily.
But the folks who the healthcare law was really designed for are the people who didn't get healthcare through their work. And for them, what's your advice when they start looking at their taxes?
Well, if you can afford it, go to an accountant. If you can't afford an accountant, you should be able to go to one of the free clinics. The IRS provides some, and there are a lot of free clinics around. But do seek some professional help. Read about it if you do not want to go to anybody. But yes, you will need help, definitely.
Let me ask about you. Do you feel that you need help? I know that you have a lot of resources. You've done this for a long time. But seriously, these are new forms. You have to ask new questions. You have to not sure maybe all the questions you need to ask every time. How are you tackling this?
It's a whole new can of worms, which we are probably going to discover as we go by. But we are getting there. I'm over anxious about it. So we have like a 3-tier check.
Tell me any stories about particular clients that might have been surprised or people who have come in. Do they know about this in your experience? Or are you the one telling a lot of your clients, hey, this is new, this is a big deal?
A lot of the clients seem informed somehow, probably even listening to the radio or the television. They do seem aware, but then we are having issues where clients didn't have a job for a few months and then signed up with Marketplace, then got a job and got a credit, and now they have to repay that credit. And they think, oh, you're doing my return wrong. I need to go somewhere else. So those kind of things. But, you know, I think the IRS, I'm more worried about the IRS, to be very honest, because the IRS does not have enough manpower. They're already very, very behind. So my worry is, how will they tackle it?
In your experience, are people finding their tax bills higher, lower? Are they? Because this is all about trying to correctly estimate the benefit that you get from healthcare. And in year one, that's so tricky. People really trying to, it's just like estimating the income, but it's not done automatically. Are you finding that people are surprised in more of a bad way or a good way when they look at this issue?
People still have a lot of ignorance. And when we tell them you have to pay this much because you didn't have health insurance, they're just shocked. And they thought, oh, I was doing government a favor by not signing up for health insurance and not taking the credit. Why do I owe money now? Or why do I have to pay penalty? So they were being the good Samaritans. Money always brings out emotions in people. And this year we have way more emotions than any other years.
Poonam Bansal, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Lisa.
And that's our show for this week. Don't forget to visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, to take our quiz on cheating. Just a few fun questions will tell you if you, dear listener, are a nefarious cheater. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Josh Wu, with help this week from digital intern Seth Kelly. Dan Tomatovich is our senior producer. Ravi Carmen is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Narin Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. Lizzie's off on assignment, working on a collaboration with our partners at the BBC. You'll hear her special reports soon. But in the meantime, Barbara Bogave is in for Lizzie next week as we talk about stories of mobility. Make sure you visit marketplaceweekend.org to tell us about your experience with the American Dream. Facebook and Twitter are also good places to find us. We're at Marketplace WKND. I'm Lisa Desjardins. Thank you for listening. This is APM.